to order. Welcome on a rainy Tuesday after Memorial Day. We're going to go a little bit out of order, committee. This is our, as I get my new agenda, this is our final meeting day authorized for these bills, so we will try to get through them. We ended yesterday, last meeting, without the ability to get to House Bill 3273. So, patiently waiting is Daryl Fuller. So, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3273 A and S. Oh, it isn't yours?
2017.
I'm sorry. 2017. I'll open up the work session, public hearing 2017. See, that's what happens when I get a revised agenda. I should have stayed with my own.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I'd be happy to testify on the bill if you'd tell me what it is.
I'm sure you do a wonderful job.
What you want me to say about it. House Bill 2017 is what I hope you will consider a housekeeping amendment to the lien perfection statutes in the state of Oregon. When you buy a motor vehicle from a dealer and you finance that vehicle through a lender of some kind, whether it's a credit union or a bank, the dealer perfects the interest of the lender by turning in the title and registration paperwork to DMV. Oregon and federal law give dealers 20 days to perfect that interest. And we do that by, again, filing the titling information. Or if the title information isn't available, there is a form called a temporary ownership document that we can also file that perfects the lender's claim on the vehicle. Congress recently passed a law that extends that 20-day time clock to a 30-day time clock, so dealers would have 30 days to perfect the interest in the vehicle. But Oregon statute still says 20, while the federal statute is going to say 30, and that could cause some confusion. So this bill simply changes the clock in Oregon statute so that the Oregon statutes will mirror the federal statutes. The bill has an emergency clause so that the Oregon change will go in effect on the exact same day as the federal change in terms of changing that clock from 20 to 30 days. And that's all it does, is give dealers an extra 10 days to complete the paperwork to perfect the interest on behalf of a lender. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Questions from the committee? Okay. I think it's pretty straightforward in conforming that and providing those days. Is no one else is set up to testify on House Bill 2017A? Is there anyone that would like to testify on House Bill 2017A? Not, we'll close public hearing on House Bill 2017A, open a work session on House Bill 2017A. Senator Starr.
2017A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2017A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. We'll ask Senator Starr to carry that bill. Thank you. Let's see. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3273. Actually, no, Dexter's here, so let me change that. We'll open up a public work session on Senate Bill 408A. We were just calling you, Dexter, so you're here. Sorry, Jared. Mr. Brockfield, we almost got to you. Mr. Johnson, if you would come forward, please. Colleagues, this is House Bill, or Senate Bill 408, that we heard last week and a half ago, or what we heard last week, that we started on a week and a half ago, again, back into this committee after being in revenue. If you recall, there were a number of issues that were brought up in committee, specifically by the utilities, wondering about whether this was a one-way or a two-way. There were some other comments about some of the definitions in the bill, and so we asked for comment on that, and Senator Walker and I get endless comments that never end. But we did our best to put those together and ask Dexter Johnson from Legislative Council, who, again, want to give kudos to. I know worked over the weekend. We were working at midnight some nights on this, him well after midnight on some nights, and we appreciate all that. What I'd like to have you do, specifically, Mr. Johnson, if you could walk through the -A8 amendment and then particularly highlight the changes that are in the amendment as a result of the hearing last week, that would be very much appreciative.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
I'd like a copy of the A8 amendment if there were copies.
We should have had one. Here you go. Take that one. Would you make sure, James, that everyone on the dais has copies of the A8?
Mr. Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The AA amendment is based on the -A7 amendment with some changes. I'll just kind of go through and section by section describe what the bill, what the amendment does, and highlight a few of the changes that have been made. Section 2 of the amendment sets forth legislative findings and declarations. It is largely the same as the A7 amendments, with the exception of subsection 6, which more accurately reflects the current and apparently long-standing practice of utility regulation, which is that a finding of fair, just, and reasonable, you'll see that on line 3 there on page 2, is actually a factual finding made by the Public Utility Commission. In the previous version, there was a per se declaration that taxes that are estimated taxes and actual taxes paid, if they're out of sync, that's per se not fair, just, and reasonable. And there was a recognition that that's, given the long-standing practice, that that's actually a factual determination. This language is modified to more accurately reflect that finding.
Just because not everybody in the audience may have a copy, I assume they do, but if you want to just read those changes to us, that would be really helpful for the record.
Okay. Subsection 6 used to read, utility rates that include amounts for taxes that are not actually paid to units of government are not fair, just, and reasonable. And now subsection 6 reads, utility rates that include amounts for taxes should reflect the taxes that are actually paid to units of government to be considered fair, just, and reasonable. The next substantive change is actually at the end of section, I'm going to talk about section 3 at length, but the previous amendments had a separate section defining the term tax, and it defined it very broadly to include property taxes, municipal franchise fees, and the like. In this, the A8 amendments, the definition of tax has been substantially narrowed and is not any longer a standalone section, but actually is a definition beginning on page 3, lines 29 and 30, and carrying forward onto the next page. And it basically makes it clear that, as used in this amendment, tax means income taxes, whether federal, state, or local, and whether or not they are built into rates or otherwise assessed against ratepayers.
And if I can interrupt you, Mr. Johnson, just because I think it's important, and you might even, for the sake of everyone in the committee, but also in the audience, is where possible, you know how those changes came about or where the input came from, I just think would be helpful. Because on this one, I think this is one I remember in particular Mr. Meek brought up around the Multnomah County tax, which I think had where this revision came from. And if you could explain how you think that addresses that, et cetera, that would be helpful.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meek had pointed out that the Multnomah County business income tax is actually not built into the rates that are assessed for electricity consumption, but rather is a separately stated line item on customer bills. And the previous amendment had basically assumed that the only taxes we were talking about were taxes that were built into rates. This amendment recognizes that, in fact, there are some taxes that are assessed, that are nevertheless estimates, but are assessed as a separate line. It actually does that not in the definition of tax, but rather in subsection 3 of section 3, line 20, or otherwise assessed to ratepayers. That picks up taxes that are not income taxes, but that are not built into the rates, but rather are separately stated. And my understanding is that the Multnomah County business income tax is actually what's in mind there. The other elements of the definition of tax, going back to page 3, that are significant, as I said, it is now limited just to income taxes, including the corporate excise tax that's measured by income. And it expressly excludes any amount and it's, that is ultimately refunded by a government unit to the utility, and that was another suggestion. It was, I believe, Mr. Meeks. Section 3, substantively, is the substance of the bill, and in the prior version, there was that started out with a provision that basically directed that a utility may not directly or indirectly charge or collect through rates any amount for tax unless the utility actually pays that. There was objection to that language, and as a result of as being a little bit too inflexible and also suggesting that that would take into account retroactive taxes that were out of sync retroactively, and there's a prohibition against retroactive, essentially retroactive rate making, which that would be. So that section was removed. That subsection was removed in the dash A8s. And basically it starts with the new reporting requirements that utilities must face. In subsection 1 there is a, most of this is carried over from the previous draft, but I'll just go over it anyways. There is a now a new tax report that utilities must file with the PUC. They must file it on or before October 15th of each year. And it sets forth in this report, it doesn't include the actual income tax returns, but it sets forth pertinent tax information, basically as required by the commission, but mandating that it be include the amount of taxes paid by the utility during any of the previous three preceding years. And years there, I think it's important to understand that that's fiscal years of the utility. A complex corporate income tax return often is amended for years to come, so you don't actually know what officially your income taxes are for many years. What this is asking that they report is the net amount of that's actually paid, whether it's as estimated taxes, as adjustments to a prior filed return, or as refunds from a prior filed return as a subtraction. The actual amount that's paid during the fiscal year period without regard to what tax year it is paid for. And that's to avoid the problem that a corporate income tax return may take years to finalize. The report is, as you can see in lines 13 and 14, for three preceding years. I want to return to that point in a minute to see what that is, but you basically look at the tax information for each of three preceding fiscal years. Subsection 2, lines 15 and 16, this is from the previous draft. The report is public. Subsection 3 directs the commission to take 90 days to review the report and then make a determination. This is a fairly significant change from the previous version. You'll see on line 21 it uses the word differed rather than exceeded and from the previous version, so that there isn't a one-way street here. If, in fact, the utilities taxes that they collected through rates or otherwise, but the estimated taxes were actually less than the amount they paid, they will get an adjustment in their favor. So it's the other language kind of assumed a kind of a one-way street, and that has now been eliminated. That was PGE, I believe, first made that recommendation for that change.
Can I interrupt you for a moment, Mr. Johnson? Because as I understand it, when that objection was raised in committee, was that our belief and understanding is that this was an actual, two-way, that that we want them to be fair and accurate. And as I recall from our discussions, you did not believe that that was not that case, that it was the case, but this was to help clarify that, whether there was any objections over that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I think the previous language probably worked as is, but this makes it a little bit clearer on its face that it is a two-way street that we're talking about here.
Okay.
The language then goes on to direct the commission, if there is this difference, to establish an automatic adjustment clause for the utility. And unlike in the previous version, it establishes a specific date by which the commission must do this. That is, within 30 days of the date they determine there, in fact, was a difference. The previous draft had kind of left it up to the commission as to when this would actually occur. Finally, the new amendment makes it very clear that the automatic adjustment clause does not attempt to collect previous overages or refund previous overages or collect previous underages, but rather applies prospectively only. You can see that on line 27, so that it's very clear that there's no retroactive rate making going on. Subsection 4 is a new language that expressly states that the automatic adjustment clause, when it is imposed by the PUC, may not be used to make adjustments to rates that are attributable to any other affiliate of the utility. So if the utility either is in a parent subsidiary relationship or is in fact the parent of subsidiaries, the automatic adjustment clause does not apply to the activities of other entities, however they're related to the utility, but only to the utility itself. Subsection 5 is basically carried forward from the previous amendment. It allows for amounts to be, the PUC to authorize amounts in excess of tax to be collected if they are deferred taxes, which is kind of a complex concept, but basically the income tax code allows for a depreciable assets to be the deduction for that to be claimed on an accelerated basis, which means you get a bigger deduction early on and then a smaller deduction in the later portion of the period of time for which you can deduct the depreciable asset. And this is current practice. The PUC allows for deferred taxes to be collected and then they are put into a special account, and then during that later period in time when the depreciation deduction is smaller than it otherwise would be because it was accelerated in the beginning, the tax payment actually comes out of this account rather than out of current rates. So this is a statement of existing practice. It was at the PUC's recommendation, the language was modified slightly to eliminate the sentence, accumulated deferred taxes shall be deducted from the rate base of the utility.
Now, Mr. Johnson, if I can stop you there. So, in your estimation then, does this section then solve that issue that we had months ago regarding which kind of short-circuited our earlier attempts on being able to handle the depreciation issue as opposed to the IRS rules? Do you believe that this addresses that issue?
Mr. Chair, I do. I think this basically puts into law what my understanding the current practice is, and the current practice from the PUC and utilities perspective is effectively deals with the depreciation issue.
So they can include these in rates for the depreciable asset. But then when they use that money then, as they will, to pay that, they won't be able to charge that to ratepayers. That will have already been considered originally. So that balances out.
That's correct. That's the second sentence there. Deferred taxes that are subsequently paid may not be charged to ratepayers. So that would permit I mean, that would prohibit a double, essentially a double counting of taxes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Sorry, just...
Subsection 6 is modified from the previous version. Basically, subsection 6 provides that... Let me restate that. Subsection 6 is carried forward from the previous amendment, but it is also modified somewhat, and I want to talk a little bit about that. Subsection 6 basically says that if the commission determines that the automatic adjustment clause will in fact result in a material adverse effect on customers, then the automatic adjustment clause need not be applied. In the previous amendment, that term, material adverse effect, there was an express definition of what that meant. In this case, in the new amendment, that definition is out. There was concern that that definition was too inflexible. And so that definition has been omitted, and in its place is a restriction on the PUC that they may not make the material adverse effect finding and therefore not impose an automatic adjustment clause unless they conduct a hearing as part of that determination. So that would allow ratepayer advocates and utilities to, in an adversarial context, argue whether or not there is, in fact, a material adverse effect.
Okay, if I can interrupt you again. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. So, the automatic adjustment clause will automatically kick in unless there is a claim that the customers are going to be damaged, and then they would have a hearing to see how the customers might be damaged by that clause. Otherwise, it would take place.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. I just want to really be clear on this. Is there a definition, a current definition in the statute for material adverse effect, or is there case law that the PUC has previously used to determine that, or have they even looked at that issue before?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, there is not an existing statutory definition of material adverse effect. I do not know whether that is a term of art that the PUC uses and has developed case law or rulings around, and maybe someone else here would be able to answer that. But.
And I think, Mr. Chair, the reason we took it out is because no one could agree on what that really meant, and we'd been here till next year trying to figure that one out. So I think that was why we went this way.
I think we had, as I recall, Senator Walker, the customers themselves were concerned about that definition.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The other definitions that you see there in subsection 8 are basically, I believe, the same from the previous amendment. Section 4 is...
Mr. Johnson, I can't remember. I know we... on page 4, line 2, was that in the previous amendment, or did we read that back from a previous version?
Well, Mr. Chair, the definition of tax is new. I did just discuss that.
Right, but I mean the sub B part.
Right. That part of the new language in the definition of tax is the express exclusion of amounts that are subsequently refunded by units of government as tax refunds. Those are not considered tax for purposes of this section. Section 4 is new. It's not a lot of substance there. It simply expressly provides that the first tax report is going to be due on October 15, 2005, and that it, in that report, the utility will report the tax information for the three most recent consecutive fiscal years. So that looks back, but the automatic adjustment clause itself, as you recall, does not look back and applies only prospectively.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Walker.
Oh, thank you. This is a good time to ask this question, I think, before it gets away from us. Why couldn't you ask for the tax report to be filed immediately upon passage of this measure? Because we have an E clause in the measure to make it effective immediately.
Mr. Chair and Senator Walker, it is a new report. The PUC, while the legislation does state some items of information that are expected to be in the report. It also authorizes the PUC to identify other information. Since it's new and since the PUC has to make some decisions, an immediate request for a report probably is not realistic. And then I think there was some interest that actually the automatic adjustment clause go into effect immediately. That's even more problematic because the PUC has to study the report and make some decisions as to whether, in fact, there really is a difference between estimated taxes and actual taxes. So that's why there's kind of this 90 to about 6 month lag time before this thing is fully implemented.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I just wanted that explained for the record. That was your softball today.
Other than that, the other Section 5 is pretty much a carry forward from the previous amendment. And Section 6 is the emergency clause. It goes into effect on passage.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions for Mr. Johnson before we move ahead? Okay. And if you could, if you're available, I know you've got a lot of demands on your time, but it's a culmination of months, so if you could stay around in case we have questions, I'd appreciate it. For the record, again, want to thank Mr. Johnson. You have no idea how many hours he has spent on this, especially the last 2 weeks. And with all the other demands that the other 90 members of the legislature has put on him, thank you so much. Another thing, too, and I'm going to ask some folks to come forward who have worked on this, just a statement of fact here. Senator Walker and I did take a little different approach here, but we felt we had to do this to bring conclusion to it. And we asked those legal representatives of the customers, the people who actually pay these rates, the businesses, the residents, and people who have advocated for those folks to help us in drafting changes to this original bill from a couple of weeks ago. They're the ones that pay the bills. And it has been an enlightening experience. I think Senator Walker will agree. Or maybe that might not be the word she would choose. But this is a very complicated issue, and we felt that the only way we're going to get that is to get to the people who actually pay the rates. And we have learned that even in that scenario, this is not a consensus project process, that as we would make suggestions or people would make suggestions and we would incorporate, we just basically tried to referee these folks. Others would object. And so I can see why nothing's ever happened over all these years, because it's very difficult to do. But they have done a magnificent job. Even as we move today, there's not agreement on every issue. The flood of emails, I know Senator Walker was showing me hers from this weekend, it was that thick. So they were working diligently over the holiday too, and because realizing this deadline for this Senate committee, and I really want to just thank you for all your diligence on that. We are in work session, but I'm going to ask people to come forward who have been involved in this, and then I will ask anybody else in the audience who wants to comment. So I think the first thing I'd like to do is ask Mr. Meek. Mr. Meek was one of the people who was participating in this email back and forth, and to come forward and give his observations on this. I also want to point out there is a Dash A9 that is not the product of this group. I believe, Senator Starr, is that your product, the Dash A9?
I authorize it.
Okay.
Not necessarily my product.
Okay. So we will talk about that and have someone introduce that. But I think right now we'll stay on point here. Mr. Meek, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Dash 8 version was made available only a few minutes ago, so my comments might not be complete about it. On Section 3, it requires the tax report by October 15th. This is an improvement over the Dash 7, which did not have any deadlines for the Commission to either require a tax report or to establish an automatic adjustment clause or for an effective date for the accounting to begin in the automatic adjustment clause. If there's any opportunity to urge any changes to this, I would say this could be done even sooner. The report simply asks whether the estimated taxes are different than the taxes actually paid. And we already know the answer to that. The answer will inevitably be yes, unless there's some incredible coincidence that the estimate in the rate case happens to be exactly correct, which I think has never happened, and it's mathematically almost impossible. So I don't know that the report serves a purpose. We know that under this bill, the automatic adjustment clause will need to be adopted by the commission because the difference between the estimate and the actual is there for every utility in every year, and so it's really a foregone conclusion. Under this bill, the commission then has 90 days to review the report. I think that's too long. It could be done in 45. It then requires the commission is then, based if the amounts differed from the estimate, is to establish the automatic adjustment clause. And I think what this bill means is when it says within 30 days following the date of the commission's determinations under this section shall establish the automatic adjustment clause, what I believe it means is that that's the starting date for the tax accounting to take place. That's the only way this makes any realistic sense. Conceivably, I suppose the commission could establish an automatic adjustment clause on, this date would be about February 15th of 2006, and then say we will begin accounting for the taxes as of, you know, March, April, May, or some other future date. But I think what you mean is that that's when the accounting should start, because that's really the only thing that's going to make this bill effective is for the accounting for taxes in the automatic adjustment clause to start as soon as possible. On page four, page three, the first subsection four, I believe what the committee is trying to do here is to avoid the problem of potential double counting of taxes paid by a consolidated group that includes more than one utility, and that's a circumstance we may well face if MidAmerica buys Pacific Power and Light. Let's say Pacific Power and Light charges ratepayers $80 million for taxes. The Iowa subsidiary of MidAmerica charges ratepayers $100 million for taxes. The consolidated group pays actually $80 million in taxes. Who gets credit for the $80 million that was paid? Does Pacific get credit for it? Or does the Iowa utility get credit for it? And what I think you're trying to avoid here is a situation where both utilities get credit for the same $80 million that was paid, when in fact there was only one $80 million paid and there wasn't two of them. So I think what you're trying to accomplish here is that amounts that are paid by the parent or by the consolidated group to government are not to be double counted, and that in fact the tax liability of the group is to be assigned to or allocated to the individual members of the group in some reasonable way. States that have done these adjustments, for example, often use the often allocate the tax liability to members of the group based upon each member of the group's contribution to the net taxable income of the group. That would be a reasonable way to do it, and I think that's what you're trying to get at here. Subsection 5, what's changed from the Dash 7 amendments is that you remove the sentence that accumulated deferred income taxes are to be deducted from rate base, which is the current practice of the commission. I don't know why the commission would ask that to be removed, because it is current practice. And if we are here enshrining current practice, that current practice does include removing the accumulated deferred income taxes from rate base. And that should continue. And this bill should not be taken to imply that that should in any way change. On subsection 6, on material adverse effect on customers, it's not a term of art in utility regulation. And surely what this bill must mean is that the commission must find a net material adverse effect on customers from the automatic adjustment clause. If you view the automatic adjustment clause in isolation, you could probably come up with some. I can't think of one, but maybe someone could think of some material adverse effect. On the other hand, you have a very large material beneficial effect on ratepayers. In the case of Portland General Electric alone, it would be about a $93 million beneficial effect on ratepayers every year. So I don't think the commission intends that the committee intends that the commission can find some adverse effect over here and not consider the massive beneficial effect on customers for the public utility in order to make this determination. Otherwise subsection 7 would not seem to make sense. On page 4, the definition of tax, I just want, since it was I was referred to as one of the sources for this change, I want to make absolutely sure that it is understood. Where subsection B on the top of that page says that tax does not include any amount that is refunded by a unit of government as a tax refund, this means that taxes paid by the utility to government under this bill are to be calculated on a net basis, that is, net taxes paid. So if you pay some taxes, but then you get it back as a refund, you haven't paid the tax. And you can't charge that to ratepayers simply because you paid it once. If you got it back as a refund, that's not a legitimate cost to charge to ratepayers. Now, this is a real consideration. In the late 1990s, Enron did file tax returns with the federal and state government that did have tax liabilities, and they did pay them. But Enron then filed amended returns that reduced the tax liabilities to zero and got all their money back. So what we're talking about here, what can be charged to ratepayers, are the taxes that the utility pays permanently, and that is net of the amounts that are refunded to the utility, because anyone can arrange for a tax refund. All you have to do is overpay and then get it back.
Mr. Meek, are you comfortable that language addresses that now?
I am comfortable that it addresses it, but then again, I'm sort of deeply into this, and I just want to make sure that anyone coming at this without without the background would understand what the point of that is.
Well, I appreciate that, and just as a pause on this for the moment, because we are building a legislative record as well. So I do appreciate that everyone who testifies on those comments making those assumptions of what we do believe we have in the bill. That's important. So thank you, Mr. Meek. Go ahead, proceed.
I don't think I have any more comments on the Dash 8 amendments.
We may have you back when we see the Dash 9s, A9s, which I'm sure you'll read over. So any questions for Mr. Meek at the moment? Okay, thank you very much. Ann Fisher and Melinda Davison, if you could come forward.
Senator,
yes, ma'am.
My comments until we talk about
both
the amendments
together. Okay, that would be fine.
Thank you.
And you would have the opportunity to do that also anyway, but I just want to, because I have not had time to even read the Dash A9 myself, as you can imagine. So, Ms. Davison, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Hi. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Melinda Davison. I'm outside legal counsel for the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. ICNU supports the Dash 8 amendments. As I testified last week, this is an extremely important issue for all ratepayers to ensure that we not have included in our rates on a going forward basis taxes that are not actually paid to taxing authorities. We believe that this bill, as currently drafted in the Dash 8 amendments, is a very good solution to a very serious problem. Essentially, from our perspective, it is a solution that sticks within the parameters of existing OPUC mechanisms, the accelerated or the automatic adjustment clause. It is a solution that is narrowly crafted. And very importantly, we think it is a balanced solution. This is not something that is lopsided in its approach. So we think that it is crafted in such a way, and we're very appreciative of the work the Legislative Council has done, that we think that this is a good, legally sustainable, and politically sustainable solution that balances the interests of the utility and ratepayers. And as a result, we are very supportive of that. And when it is an appropriate time, we'd like to comment on the Dash 9 amendment.
Well, why don't we go ahead? I haven't had a chance to read it. I have an idea what it's about. But why don't you go ahead and give us your view of how the A9 will differ from the A8?
The A9 amendment is significantly different than the A8 amendment, and ICNU would strongly oppose the A9 amendment. This amendment does several things that are in stark contrast to the A8 amendment. As I read it, and again, I have not had much time to review this, so if I am misinterpreting something, I will apologize in advance. But my reading of the A9 amendments, first, it is in Section 2, a true-up of the utility taxes one way or the other. In other words, the problem that we are trying to address in the A8 amendments is the situation in which the utility collects tens of millions of dollars in taxes and its parent, for a variety of reasons, does not pay those taxes. The A9 amendment is not dealing with the issue of the parent. It's basically Section 2 is doing a true-up of what the utility taxes might happen to be for a particular year. So that isn't really the issue that we're concerned about here as ratepayers. But more importantly, where we are very concerned is that if you go on to the second page of the A9 amendments, it talks about if there is a change in the amount of taxes that are paid, which there likely will be, then you look at the reasons for those changes and you have a true-up of all the utility costs that contribute to that change. And since we are talking about income taxes here, you are conceivably looking at a true-up of all utility costs. That is a very, very significant change in how utilities collect their dollars. This would just be a fundamental change in utility regulation. If you are inclined to go down a path of essentially keeping the utility whole for all of their costs, if you have a true-up at the end of the year for all of their costs, then you have essentially taken all risk out of the utility operation. And that would then require a corresponding significant change in the authorized level of ROE. In other words, currently PGE has a 10.5% ROE, which compensates them for the use of their money as well as for the risk of the utility operation. If you take that major piece away, in other words, the utility no longer has any risk, they're going to recover all the dollars they expend that year, then you have to make a corresponding change to the authorized rate of return. So this is a very significant change to the way utilities are regulated, and I think that if the committee is interested in going this direction, there needs to be a very full and complete debate of these issues and a much more complete review of this. The A8 amendments we consider to be very balanced. A9 is incredibly lopsided and extremely only in the favor of the utility.
Thank you, Ms. Davidson. And again, thank you, Ms. Davidson, for your very hard work. Also one of our email buddies over the last 2 weeks. Questions for Ms. Davidson? Senator Atkinson. Yes.
Thank you. Just one quick question. Thank you for your testimony on both amendments. You said a phrase that I haven't heard before, politically sustainable. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I believe that when you're dealing with issues that I think the tax issue has both a legal component as well as a political component. I think that the public in general is certainly upset, including costs in their rates that are not ultimately paid to the taxing authorities. And I think that when you look at the whole balance of the picture, it needs to be balanced both politically as well as legally.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Davidson, you testified that you support it. I'm so glad we're here at this point. Let me just ask you, is there any language at all in the A8 that you find objectionable, that you want to continue working on? Or are you satisfied with the way we've figured it all out?
I believe there's just a couple of little minor things that are overlooked. They are not substantive, just a couple of very, very minor cleanups that are not substantive that I would recommend be made at the appropriate time. Having said that, I believe this language is well written, and we support the language as it currently appears.
Thank you.
One final question for now, for myself, and I may be asking the obvious, but since we are building a legislative record also, I think that's important. And as you represent the large industrial customers who pay their rates to either PGE or Pacifico or maybe Northwest Natural, do you believe by supporting this amendment to the bill that your customers, those who pay these rates to the utilities, will be better off, more fairly treated than they are currently in the current system?
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct, and I think it is very important that we get back to the basics of utility rate making, which is that the utility should only collect those prudently incurred costs, that is, the cost they incur, and then be able to pass this on to ratepayers. And this is a very important fix to what many have called a loophole in that.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Davidson. What I'm going to do, we're going to have Ms. Fisher and Cub up as well, but I think what I'm going to do is shift gears for a moment and ask those who have a funny feeling will not support the Dash A8 and may support the A9 amendment to come forward. Again, we're in work session, so I don't have a sign-up sheet, but representatives, I believe, of the utility industry, if you would like to come forward, might as well come at once. And then we'll get back to Jason and Ann.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Teresa Miller. I'm here representing PGE. And my comment on the Dash A9s would be, from our perspective, the Dash A9s address the tax issue just as the A8 amendment does, except it does it in a fairer way because it essentially recognizes that taxes are derived directly from revenues and costs. And our amendment reflects that connection by providing for a true-up of taxes, but it also provides for a true-up of the costs and revenues that result in those taxes. So in our new language in the A9s, if you look at the bottom of page 1, sub B, section 2, sub B, that's essentially the language that provides for the true-up of the costs and revenues that directly affect taxes and how they end up. So that is what I would say about the Dash A9s.
Do you have any comment on the Dash A8s?
We do not support the Dash A8s. They're very similar to what we saw in the A7s, and Pamela was here last week to comment on those. So,
okay. We'll make a round table, and then we'll ask questions. Sir, welcome.
I'm Randy Dahlgren with Portland General Electric, and I'm our rate geek, and here to answer rate-making questions.
Do you have any observations, sir, on any of the comments that have been made so far on since you're the rate-making geek? Self-described.
Self-described, absolutely. Again, I think it's important that we recognize the tie between revenues and costs and income taxes that are paid. And to the A9 amendments, I think, more accurately reflect and fairly reflect the tie between those.
Okay. Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. On the A8s, I guess I appreciated what Ms. Davidson's comment, that what you were trying to get at with those amendments was a holding company type of structure, and that those were the tax problems you were concerned about. Northwest Natural does not have a holding company, as I've mentioned before, yet we are a utility, so we are included in this process. And again, our concern is that our tax liability is directly affected by all of our other costs. And so I think that's the folks that put together the A9s were trying to at least recognize that. If not, you're back with A8s, where you're basically, if you have an increased expense, it will lower your taxes, so you'll pay for the increased expense, and you'll also refund money in the taxes, so you're paying twice. Thank you.
Questions. My first question is, and anyone can chime in on this one. In all fairness, all these issues in terms of, you know, whether it's power costs, transmission costs, anything that may, in your case, as utility folks, exceed what you have based in rates, what's extraordinary costs or whatever, you already have a mechanism, do you not, in the PUC? In fact, people are before the PUC right now. It keeps them very busy, in which you can address an adjustment to accommodate those costs. But I am unaware of any time that any utility has ever gone before the PUC for an adjustment on the fact that they collected too much taxes. And I think, unless I'm missing something here, that adjustments for these other extraordinary costs, you have a process and exercise that on a regular basis.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I could address that a little bit. We do have some mechanisms. They typically are forward-looking. We have a mechanism that annually adjusts power costs, but they don't adjust for changes that actually occur. It's still a forecast. Those actual changes, whether they be increased load, decreased load, that affects revenues and costs, or better hydro. We can always hope that, again, we'll get to a situation where we have good hydro. Lowers costs. Would tend to increase taxes. Would actually be perverse, I think, to our customers' interests. But, again, the mechanisms that we typically have, again, are based on an estimate and look forward, whereas the automatic adjustment clause, once it's established, captures on an actual basis, not projected. So all of these additional changes that affect income taxes would run through that.
Mm-hmm. One follow-up, then I'll open up to the committee for questions, is that do you understand why the public sees taxes differently than other costs? And the other costs are going to be adjusted. You do have the opportunity, and you do go before the PUC to have those adjustments. And people understand that if there are extra costs, and that is, there's a hearing process, and a lot of people in this room are involved with that. Taxes are viewed, I think correctly viewed, as a liability to the state for services based on, you know, your net revenues. And that that if they become, as they have been, simply a cushion to adjust other rates, then they've lost their meaning as a specific assessment for a specific purpose, which is to provide goods and services to the citizens of Oregon as taxes. That they really aren't taxes. They become another cost in which that the ratepayer believes should, in fact, be the taxes actually paid to government. I mean, from a fairness issue, I mean, do you understand why this is, I think, in many of our minds, I think most citizens' minds, should be treated differently than other costs, and that those other costs are being, that there are mechanisms to deal with those straight up, rather than using, you know, the cushion of extra millions of dollars in taxes to internally adjust for that. I just would like a comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Gary Bauer, we share with you the frustration, and particularly with our customers, the frustration over income taxes. And I think, again, our frustration is that somehow it's been painted as if income taxes are a totally separate amount on the bill within your rates, and they're really not. It's part of the overall formula that a utility is given in terms of the amount of that they can charge to cover all of their expenses. And we don't have an automatic way of adjusting for all of our expenses. We do, Northwest Natural does, have a purchase gas adjustment, which we do adjust annually. The reason we do that is because we charge wholesale. Whatever we pay for gas, we pass on to our customers at the wholesale level. So there's not an adjustment. It's not a profit issue. The other expenses are dealt with in a rate case at the same time that taxes are dealt with.
Mr. Chair, can I just add one thing to that? The only other thing I would say in this debate, I think a lot of people have been talking about Enron and using that as an example, and I realize that that makes a fine example of this in the past, but I guess the only point I would make is that going forward, right now, PGE is on a path to become our own company again, and April of next year, probably at the latest, will be deconsolidated from Enron. So from PGE's perspective, we'll be paying taxes as a standalone company at that point. So just...
And I think that is understood. But what we're looking at as a legislature is broad public policy. We can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow. No one would have predicted that PacifiCorp would all of a sudden be approached by another mega-affiliated corporation. And looking after the public interest would require that we set broad public policy, not for a specific instance, even though clearly a specific instance surely brought this on the consciousness, I think, of the citizens. Questions from the committee? Senator Atkinson, then Senator Walker.
Yeah,
I realize we're been committeeizing for 5 months on Enron and politically sustainable options, but two quick questions. Number one, define for me, help me understand fairness. That's a big issue, and that, which leads into my second question. So help me understand the fairness side one more time. I'm a simple country boy. It's the first time I've ever been to the big city.
I guess an example that came to mind is I try to do my own personal income taxes. If I have a huge medical expense for whatever reason, I would expect to be able to put that in my Schedule A.
Mr. Chair, but in my personal, I'm not, the PUC has got nothing on me with my medical expenses. So take me through fairness from a business standpoint.
I personally get to deduct unforeseen expenses. We as a utility have either unforeseen expenses or revenues that affect our taxability. And I think it's fair if we're paying out, for example, an extra amount for costs as a utility, that tax impact, the entity that's bearing the additional cost should get the tax benefit. A fair balance of costs and benefits.
Let me ask another, my second question, which is a little bit more direct. Would it be fair to assume under the Dash 8s, even in a regulated market, that a publicly managed company like this, let me say publicly regulated company like this, could increase costs to lessen a tax liability? Do you have that ability to do that under the Dash 8s? Meaning, again, taking me back to, you know, business. Sometimes we'll go out and at the end of the year, some clients will go out and spend all kinds of money just to lower tax liability to get under different tax brackets. Do you have that ability increase under the Dash 8s?
I'm not aware of how that would be financially beneficial. There's no tax breaks. Basically, our tax rate's about 40% by the time you get to the increment, and which means if you spend a dollar to get 40 cents in tax benefit,
I think you're making it harder than it is. Can, under a company that is publicly managed under the PUC, publicly regulated, can you drive up expenses to lower your tax liability under the Dash 8s? Can you do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I'll take a stab at it. And I think what Mr. Dahlgren was trying to point out is that if you aren't getting additional revenue for that expense, let me back up. Yes, you could, just as anybody could try to find ways of driving up an expense to offset their taxes. I think what we're trying to say is it doesn't make sense if your revenue is still at a certain level, which the PUC sets as your rate, to incur additional expenses, as Mr. Dahlgren said, at a dollar, to get 40 cents off on your taxes. You've lost 60 cents in that process. So, while yes, theoretically you could, it doesn't make good business sense to us.
Senator Walker, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciated Senator Atkinson's question about a definition of fairness, because heretofore it has not been very fair, ladies and gentlemen. Do either of you know how much every single day the City of Portland and all the ratepayers are paying out to Enron right now for taxes that Enron never paid? They collected, but they never paid.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I don't have that figure.
Well, it's a significant sum of money. Mr. Meek can generally spout it off the top of his head. I always have to look it up because it's rather stunning. But I think, at the last hearing, you folks testified that you didn't think the automatic adjustment clause was two-way, but I think we have testimony on the record from Mr. Johnson and our excellent skills at drafting have indicated that it's two-way. So what is your objection?
Senator Metzger and Senator Walker, they actually changed the language to make sure it was two-way. That was a change between the dash 7s and the dash 8s. So I believe it is two-way now. Okay. I'm not sure it was in the dash 7s.
Okay. So you don't object to that part anymore?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, that's good. We're making progress. I'm not quite sure we're ever going to get there with you folks, though, because I think what's important to ratepayers and the public at large is that you're not allowed to collect taxes that you don't owe and that you don't pay. And I think that's what we're trying to get to here. And I'm not sure your dash 9, well, I am sure your dash 9 won't get us there. But thanks for your good effort.
Thank you, Senator. Questions? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Well, I might disagree with the senator from Eugene. The question I have is, from my perspective, the issue is a real one, that if you're paying taxes, and those taxes are included in the rates, and you don't pay what the rates assume, you shouldn't collect that in the rates. And apparently the A8s do that, and your contention is that it's not a fair way to do it, and the A9s apparently do it as well, and your contention that's a fair way to do it. I want you to explain to me the difference. I'm looking at the rate geek to do that, because this is an issue that's now some people in this room have dealt with this apparently into the wee hours of the night, and I appreciate that. And some of us have not, but I want you to explain to me in real English, for the legislative record, that we're building on this issue, the difference in your opinion on why the A8s aren't fair to utilities, and why, in my mind, again, there's a real problem here with taxes, that if you charge them, you got to pay them. And if the A8s aren't the fair way to do it, you got to convince this committee and this legislature why the A9s are the answer.
I'll certainly try. Thank you. I guess I'd hearken back to the presentation that Ms. Lesh, I believe, gave last week, and went through a couple examples of changes in revenues and or costs and how it affected taxes. And I guess from my point of view, the A8s are not fair to utilities, but they're also not fair to customers, in that there are circumstances where the impact goes the other way. And one example...
My understanding is in the A8, they've adjusted the language in that bill so that if it goes the other way, it's in the utility's favor. So, okay... That answers that question. Next question.
Let me go over the example again, where, for example, the economy recovers very well, or there's a long cold snap, revenues are up for the utility, substantial amount. Our power costs go up, but not as much as revenues go up, so we have an increase to net income as a result of that cold snap. So customers paid more. They had higher bills because of that. If you then look at higher net income, higher income taxes, under the A8 amendments, the automatic adjustment clause would capture those higher income taxes that are due because of the higher revenues. So customers would end up paying twice. They'd pay higher bills, and they'd end up having to pay the increased taxes also. That's why the A9 amendments take into account the higher revenues, the higher costs associated with that, to see what the overall impact is, not just isolated on income tax.
So, Mr. Chair, let's just jump in here. So then, under the A9 amendments, the customers would not ultimately pay pay both higher rates because of a cold winter and then see higher rates again because your tax bill was higher.
That's right.
Further questions? Senator Decker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just follow up on the point that it sounded like to me, and I find myself in a similar place as Senator Starr, frankly, is that I've been looking for a rationale on this of why the basic principle is that if taxes are embedded, then they ought to be paid. And I've been looking for a rationale, and up until this point I haven't heard it. I heard a little scintilla of a rationale right there with the symmetry argument. But what I also hear is that customers as a whole are willing to take that gamble, which then it's just a principle that you're willing to, on the tough years, live with maybe a slight increase, because if you look at history and you look at the way this is run, that it's traditionally been on the other side. So I guess I would just put the question back to you of customers as a whole, because it sounds the argument that you're making is that we want to protect the customers on these odd years. And I guess where I land is the customer as a whole seem to be saying, we're willing to take that gamble. We see the upside over here, and we're willing to lose on the downside. But I guess I'd give you one more opportunity to convince me both on the rationale side, because that was the first time I've heard at least some rationale of why they shouldn't be embedded in rates. And then secondly, why are the customers missing? What are they not seeing here that perhaps on this one, your perspective, because you're dealing with the PC every day, maybe you're picking it up.
Well, Senator, I think that certainly the customer groups have their perspective, and from mine, I do look at it from both sides. Obviously, there's the customer impact, an example I went through. There's a customer company impact if costs go the other way, that there's a big run-up in medical costs. We're having to pay additional benefit costs that aren't included in rates. To me, there is a fairness issue of, well, if who should get the income tax effect of those higher costs that the utility incurred? I think that the entity that bore those costs should get the tax effect of those costs. And that's why under the A9 amendments, it aligns the costs and revenues and the income tax impact.
I guess I just have a hard time. I know this is an endless debate, but I have a hard time pulling in other related costs, because I understand in a PUC case you have to look at the whole realm of costs that the utility incurs. But to me, it's hard on the tax one, because I guess I see it as such a simple, true set rate that really doesn't deviate much. And to pull in medical costs or other costs and try to embed those into it, I guess I struggle with how the rationality of that. But I'm operating on lack of sleep today, so maybe that's...
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I could just take one shot. I think our perspective on this is just the fact that what the taxes end up being actually are directly related to whatever those costs were. And so we just feel like if you're going to look at taxes, you can't just separate them and say, okay, let's take taxes alone, because those taxes are derived from whatever your costs and revenues are. So linking them makes sense, I think, and that's the sort of the fairness argument, because taxes are just a result of whatever your costs and revenues are. So to say, let's treat taxes separately, sort of ignores that connection, I guess.
Mr. Chair, if I might add one more thing for Senator Decker's question. In the rate proceeding where you established what the amount ought to be for taxes, it was after looking at your test case, which again assumed revenues and your costs. So if once you leave that rate proceeding, to the extent the taxes have changed for Northwest Natural, because we don't have a holding company, it's because costs and other things have changed. And I guess that's what I've been trying to point out. It's not that we're taking, and I totally understand your concerns and your frustrations about collecting money from Oregonians and then shipping it off somewhere else. Northwest Natural does not have a holding company. And all I'm trying to say in this whole process is that as you've developed this, and even as the proponents had talked about, they were trying to get at the dollars that are basically collected in Oregon and then maybe sent off somewhere else. So that's why we're trying to point out, and I think that's why this issue has been going on for all session and actually for a few years in terms of trying to find some way to find a balanced solution. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to dismiss this panel for now.
Can I?
Senator Ana Sanders.
Yes.
Yes.
Just real, hopefully this can be answered simply. We have shareholders, and shareholders aren't considered part of other related costs, or are they? And when we're in a recession, have our shareholders in PGE or Northwest Natural, well, of course, Enron, it's different. They're in a or when the cost of utilities is high, does that mean more money for the shareholders? And I guess I'm trying to see a correlation. You don't want shareholder costs to be in, and yet you want the taxes to be considered part, I view it as operating costs, and I know they're not, but that's how I view it. Do you have a comment on trying to do shareholder when you have a high price for the utility, I mean for energy, it costs a lot. That's great for the shareholders, correct?
No.
Okay, that's what I want you to explain.
I'll try and, please follow up, because in the rate making process, basically what one does is add up what is determined to be a prudent level of expenses, whether they be power costs, medical costs, salaries, benefits, all that type of thing. Look at all O&M costs, and then added to that is an element for recovery of debt and equity financing. Equity is shareholders. And that basically, you add all that up, and I'll make it more complicated, but you divide by kilowatt hours and get a rate. And that's what is then charged going forward. Once rates are set and you go forward, you're just like any other business. The shareholder return is the last thing that falls out the bottom. You pay all your expenses, pay your interest, and a return drops off the bottom, hopefully. The fact that power costs, for example, go up, there's no return element associated with that. Again, O&M costs are just covered dollar for dollar. So the fact that costs go up, power costs go up, does not yield a higher return for shareholders. And in fact, if you've set rates and then they go up after you've set rates, it's eating into the return. So my short answer was no.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to, we're talking about other related costs, and mm-hmm. and I know there are costs that aren't a part of the rate making. I mean, shareholders, you certainly aren't putting that in the cost of the rate setting.
There is a return to shareholders as a component
in the rate setting.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ann Fisher and Jason Eisendorfer, if you could please come forward.
Eisendorfer.
I always get that wrong. Sorry, Jason. Jason.
You can just be a one-day moment person.
These two folks are also part of our email buddies the last couple of weeks, and appreciate that. Jason, I think we'll defer to Ann to start. And I think what we'll do here, as we're wrapping up this, comment on the A8 and the A9, as you've requested. I think we've had the utility perspective, and Jason, as you as well. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I've been watching you very carefully, and I haven't noticed any of your eyes glaze over. People ask me what I do, and as soon as I start rattling off that I do electricity, you see their eyes sort of drift to the back of their head. And so I appreciate all of your attention, and I know that this is very complicated and where a lot of energy walks.
Please identify yourself for the record, by the way.
Chairman Metzger, I'm happy to do so. I'm Ann Fisher, and I represent Building Owners and Managers Association of Portland. On my way down here, I called back to the BOMA offices to find out what that meant in square footage, because I thought that might be better than just saying, as I usually do, which is most of the large buildings, strip malls, industrial parks in the Portland metropolitan area. Well, the number I got back was 7 billion square feet of commercial property, which is no small amount, even by any standards. We've been part of the email buddies. It was a good day for the pulp and paper industry this weekend because we, I'm sure, used up many reams of paper trying to find solutions to what is a very difficult problem. And the problem is, as you all know, that there is an ability in the way rates are handled that would allow rates to be collected but not actually paid to any governmental unit. That means folks like my BOMA members get charged twice. They pay those extra rates, higher rates in electricity prices, then you all come back and say, wouldn't you like to pay a little more in taxes to cover some of the essential services that we have otherwise? So it's a critical issue to everyone. What we looked at were ways to make sure that that wouldn't happen. Now, the rate setting scenario is probably worth mentioning at least briefly. What happens when a utility needs to set its rates? It goes in and then it files a rate case. And as Gary Bauer represented, that you start off with a test year and you figure out costs and what needs to be done and what the services are going to look like. And the commission puts it all together with the help of a lot of interveners and, of course, the utilities, and figures out an appropriate rate of return that reflects sort of the risk to the shareholders for having this investment. It's a package deal, and it goes forward for some period of time. If the utility doesn't come back in, it means it's pretty much satisfied. Now, it could be satisfied because it has exactly matched its costs with the actual costs and anticipated revenues out there, and everything looks exactly as we estimated, or it might not come back because it turns out that they were able to do a better purchase with power or get a better deal here, and there's a little extra money that comes in, and the utility's entitled to keep that. You don't get, the utility doesn't come back in and say, well, you know, we're sort of over-collecting here, so the customer should get a rebate. Doesn't happen. That means that as often as the costs change, the utilities can come back and ask for new rates and provide the backup to get those. That brings me to where we are today. I looked at the dash 9s and I looked at the dash 8s and I tried to put them together and I did a cut and paste and you didn't see all the machinations that I did here. But what occurred to me happens in the dash 9 is that the utilities want a second bite. Because what they're asking you to do in the Dash 9 is not just find fairness. They're asking you to give them a little extra. So if in all of that, all the stuff that the commission put together to establish their rates in the first place doesn't quite add up right, and that has as simultaneous with the fact that the taxes were collected but not paid for whatever reason, then to get the taxes back, the customers will also have to go through what amounts to a mini rate case so that we can look at all those costs again. And you know, it becomes one of those overwhelming and unwieldy process. But I took a look at what Dash 9 does to see if we could improve Dash 8. I came down here to support Dash 8. We worked awfully hard to find the best possible compromise. Nobody came to fisticuffs, but, you know, that was only because we were separated by space, not because we weren't at that point at times. And it looks like there are a couple of things that you find in Dash 9 that could be maybe used to tweak Dash 8.
I like Dash 8. I like it because it has Section 2, which goes through and talks about what I think you all believe. You believe that the taxes should not be collected in rates and then not paid. It says that this isn't the way we want to run our state when and how the utilities handle it. It attempts to find a solution, and the solution is what we call an automatic adjustment clause. We have those. For instance, if a utility has extraordinary power costs, it can go in and ask for an automatic adjustment clause outside of a rate case to say, this cost was extraordinary, let's have some adjustment. It puts forth this automatic adjustment clause, which will be based upon how much was paid in taxes and how much was collected, and we'll figure out who's high and who's low, and we'll take care of it going forward. There's a lot of issues about whether or not it should go forward or retroactively, but we all agree that going forward is a positive thing, and we should support it for that basis. At the end of the day, it's intended to keep things on an even keel so that whatever is collected and whatever is paid match up pretty clearly. It also has some additional language that has to do with automatic adjustment clauses and how taxes are treated, which don't show up in the Dash 9 amendments at all, and I think those are the kind of amendments that are just really to keep things consistent more than anything else. And so no matter what you do, those stay. But this is how I would change the Dash 8 amendments. I would add under Section 3 a subsection 1C. Currently, it requires that everyone files a tax report, and the tax report will say how much they paid and how much they collected. The part that I would add is additional information, which, and I don't have exact language here, but that the utilities analysis of the reason that the amount paid versus the amount collected differ. The idea that's captured there is the one that Mr. Dahlgren raised, is sometimes there are things that go on, greater revenue due to things that could not have been reasonably anticipated that the commission might want to consider. But I would put it into what the commission considers so at the end of the day the commission can decide whether or not to have the automatic adjustment clause or to, as it says in toward the end, whether to let it go or not, you know, I'll say condition it. That puts the onus on the commission. The commission set the rates in the first place. The commission takes a look at what happened. The commission makes a decision about what should happen going forward. The commission understands where the utilities are coming from and why they are what they are. And then they handle it. Takes you all out of it, but makes it clear because of Section 2 that the direction to the commission is that taxes should not be collected that aren't being paid. So I support the Dash 8. I'd add a little extra information for that commission to consider. And I think that you could all go forth and feel like you did something good today if you pass it.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Fisher. We'll definitely consider this as the bill moves forward. Thank you very much. Jason.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorf, attorney with the Citizens Utility Board. I will be very brief. I'll be brief on the A8s. I think this is an important fix in the long-standing mismatch in utility regulation rate making. It does what we want to do. It ties taxes paid in rates with taxes paid to the taxing authority. It does have an off-ramp if there are unintended consequences, but for the most part, this bill does what we want it to do. So let me spend just a few minutes talking about the A9s and why we would oppose those. We think that the A9s, I've seen these now for an hour or so, so it's not written as well as I would have liked, and so I think it's English, and so if I'm understanding this wrong, I'll stand corrected. As I read them, though, the A9s are a way to oppose the tax utility bill, the A8s, in a way that isn't too vigorous, because the A8s really does get us to closer to fairness, and the A9s is simply a way to oppose that from the utility point of view. There are two fundamental differences between taxes and all other costs. As I read A9 is really a true-up of all costs within the utility system. And the fairness argument I think we heard goes, well, if you're going to true-up taxes, you have to true-up all other costs. And that's simply not true. And here are the two reasons taxes are different from all other costs. The first reason is that customers think, and I think we hope that the legislature also thinks, that taxes are a special interest, of special interest. The system that we have going right now is that under the guise of taxes, justified by the taxing authority of this state, the utilities are collecting more from customers than they are actually paying to those taxing authorities. And in our mind, that is a different kind of cost than all other utility costs. Which brings me to the second big difference. We pay utility shareholders a profit in rates. We cannot avoid that. It's hardwired into our rates. And we pay shareholders a profit so they will make good business decisions, to invest in resources, to invest in the utility infrastructure in an efficient manner, and to take some risk. We do not provide the shareholders a profit based on how creative the parent company's tax accountants are. We don't pay the utility a profit based on where the holding company stores debt, which is a source of tens of millions of dollars of mismatch in what customers are charged versus what is actually paid. Literally, it's simply where debt is stored, whether it's at the utility or at the holding company. And credit rating agencies look at the overall amount of the debt anyway, and simply where you store it creates a mismatch. Ms. Davidson said something that is absolutely true, and let me reiterate this. One of the reasons that we pay a return, a profit to the utility shareholders, is they take a risk. They take risks when they put up capital to invest in resources. If in A9, as I read this, we're constantly truing up actual costs, utilities are not taking any risk. The only way to make A9's palatable is if you added a provision that tied the utility shareholder profit margin to Treasury bills, which is essentially a non-risk margin. There is a word for a situation where the customer takes all the risk. It's called public power. Public power, the customer is assigned all the risk ultimately, and there is no profit for the shareholder. Essentially, what A9, as I read it, is attempting to do is to shift all of the risk onto the customer and yet still provide a profit to the shareholder, and that simply is unacceptable, obviously. A9, it looks innocuous, but what it would do is essentially throw out all utility rate-making regulation. So, again, Citizens Utility Board supports A8. We think it's a long time coming, and we oppose the -9 amendments.
Okay. Questions for the committee?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Walker.
I would just make a comment that was really a very good explanation, that latter point. So, essentially, the A9s would give the utilities their cake, and they could eat it, too. So, thank you for that very clear explanation after an entire weekend of wondering where my head was going next. That was simple, direct. I appreciate it. And you have not commented on email all weekend.
No, I actually had a vacation over the vacation.
Doesn't count.
We would have liked one, huh, Senator Walker?
Yeah, it was my birthday on Sunday, and I'm at the computer.
Happy birthday. Other questions from the committee?
Answered my question.
I do have a question.
Senator Starr.
Ms. Fisher, you were here the other day when Ms. Lesh from PGE gave her explanation.
Correct? I was not, but I heard it.
Okay, you weren't here.
Senator, I'm Chair and Senator Starr.
Did you happen to you heard her testimony?
Yeah.
So you heard her explain kind of the various scenarios of how, in her estimation, the taxpayer or the customer is negatively impacted by the AA8s?
Well, I think, though, Chairman Metzger and Vice Chair Starr and Senators, I think the real question that she was answering was focused on the prior that did not have the reciprocal nature in it. And she really, and I can play out scenarios myself where you can say, okay, you've adjusted the taxes, but the parent isn't putting any more money in, and so to make up for this, you wind up not collecting enough money, which causes a decrease in service, and these things fall down the line. You can do that. That's from an analysis of utility practices, that's possible. But I think that the group worked very hard to come up with a way to make sure that that particular event would not occur. So it does two things. It is reciprocal now, so that if the utilities can no longer complain, as Pamela did, that they would undercollect and then be left holding a tax bag. So we've corrected that. Nor is it a scenario where it would be so automatic that the customers would see perhaps the same rates, but what was really recovered that went to the pay the cost was so much less that they saw a loss of reliability or have problems with the way they provided the services overall. So by giving this out clause, as I think that's what Jason called it, the ability to say if there's a material adverse impact, and that's a commission decision on what that would be, with I'm sure all of us weighing in, it is intended to mitigate those kind of scenarios that Pam was describing. Yes, they're conceivable, but I think that the new Dash 8A amendments correct that.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, committee, we have, like I say, many months on this. We've heard today from the utilities and from those who pay that. Again, Mr. Meek, would you like to comment again? Yes. You haven't commented on the A9, so. Yeah, please do. I'm sorry. I would like you to do that. And then we'll go to Chris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Meek. I'm a PGE ratepayer. The A9 is, of course, modeled in a large degree on the A8. And I think there's some confusion about on the A7. I think there's some confusion about what the A8 actually says, and it feeds into both what Mr. Dahlgren said about the cold snap and the utility having higher net income, and everything that Pamela Lesh said at the hearing last week. Under the A7 and the A9, the comparisons that are made are the estimated taxes in rates versus the actual taxes paid by the utility. Estimate versus actual paid. But the A8 is not that. The A8 removed from the calculation the estimate of taxes, and the A8 simply compares the amount of taxes charged to ratepayers versus the amount of taxes paid by the utility. It's no longer comparing an estimate with an actual. It's comparing an actual with an actual. And that nullifies really what Pam Lesh had to say, because we're no longer comparing the estimate with the actual. For example, let's look also Mr. Dahlgren's cold snap example. Under the cold snap example, the reason that the utility has higher net income is because it has higher net sales of kilowatt hours. The way rate making works right now for PGE, you take $92.6 million and you include it in rates to pay for PGE's alleged state and local income taxes. In order to derive a per kilowatt hour rate, you divide the 92.6 goes into the number of kilowatt hours and increases the charges on the bill per kilowatt hour by approximately 7%. So if you have a cold snap and you sell more kilowatt hours, in fact, ratepayers have paid more in income taxes already. So you don't have to make the adjustment that Mr. Dahlgren just mentioned, because you've already paid more in income taxes. On the other hand, if you have a warm snap and fewer kilowatt hours are sold, then ratepayers have already paid less in income taxes, because the comparison under Dash 8 is what the ratepayers paid, not what was estimated in rates. And what the ratepayers paid does depend upon the number of kilowatt hours sold during each period. And as far and regarding the Dash 9s, there are some very interesting provisions in the Dash 9s.
Anything you might share with us?
It would require more thought on my part.
Would it be fair to say you would oppose the Dash A9s?
I would reserve judgment on that, actually.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Meek. Okay. Anyway, as I said, we've had an opportunity to hear from all this. I do believe, colleagues, this is a huge issue, and it is very clearly, I mean, both in business and in revenue, we've heard this issue in various forms for 4.5 months. If it was really easy, I guess it would have been done a long time ago. But it is an important issue. I think people have a right to believe that if they're paying taxes, they're going to be collected by government. To do anything different really is not fair, just, and reasonable. I think the people have done a good job, and I appreciate during the course of this discussion, both the PUC and the utilities and prior renditions, their discussion on this, and particularly those who pay these bills the last couple of weeks, trying to find a solution that actually works on this. I believe the AA gets us there, and certainly not opposed to, as some people have mentioned, some technical work when we get in the House, if that can even improve upon a good product. But I believe that's where we are. I think it does serve the interests of citizens. I think it has a real opportunity in this first go-around to cut the taxes of people who have been paying these for a long time. And then hopefully, over about a two-year period, there will be symmetry, and we won't have those discrepancies. And people will know when they're paying those that they will actually have them. So the chair would prefer to entertain a motion to adopt the A8 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes-Anderson.
I move that the Dash A8s to Senate Bill 408.
Senator Montes-Anderson has moved the Dash A8 amendment to Senate Bill 408. Further discussion on the A8 adoption. Senator Deckard.
Mr. Chair, I just one thought that I'd like to at least put on the record is that I wasn't party to the A8s, and so I don't know if they're perfect, if they get everything that we want to do done in them. But I've been convinced this whole debate over this in the last 4 months is that any action that we would take that would move the ball forward and actually create a better environment, and I have yet to hear really a cogent reason that you wouldn't move forward, I've just yet to hear it. And so the A8s to me are something that I haven't had the time to read through every comma and period, but to me it moves the discussion forward, and so I would support the A8s as something that I think it's an important issue for Oregonians, and I think it's an important issue that we would move forward on today.
Thank you, Senator. Other discussion? Senator Atkinson.
All session I have been voting against things that we could have fixed to make them even technically accurate. Why wouldn't we want to make this technically accurate to save time? Why wouldn't we do it right the first time?
Well, Senator Atkinson, in fairness to your question, I don't think it's a question of being technically accurate. It's a question of people having different of opinions. But I think we've heard the testimony. They believe this does accomplish the task, that there's not an inaccuracy there. Other people would have different opinions about how they might refine things different ways, but that the testimony clearly tells us that this moves and does accomplish the task.
I respectfully disagree. That's all right.
I understand that. Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Okay. Please take the roll on the Dash A8.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Decker?
Puts aye.
Senator Montes-Anderson?
Yes.
Senator Starr?
No.
Chair Metzger?
Aye. The Dash A8 has been adopted. Senator Montes-Anderson?
I move Senate Bill 408. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Montes-Anderson has moved Senate Bill 408 as amended by the Dash A8 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator
Aye.
Senator Montes-Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Chair
Metzger? Aye. Senate Bill 408 having received constitutional majority is declared pass, and the chair will carry.
Possible keeping an issue alive.
To the surprise of everyone, Senator Atkinson has declared notice of, I think, of a minority report. So that is so noted for the record. Thank you, Senator. Okay. And by the way, for those of you in the audience, since this is our last day on these bills, we do not have a committee coming in. We will complete the agenda. Let's go to a public hearing on House Bill 3273A, if Jared Broadfoot is still here, and see if we can move him forward with a little less discussion.
Absolutely.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot here today representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association in support of House Bill 3273 and the -A3 amendments. Real briefly to the -A3 amendments, they're a technical fix included in the original Angross version of the bill from the House side was the Master Builder Program. We agreed with the Home Builders Association to take them out since it's a program. They didn't need to be affected by this bill, so we had consensus on that, agreed to remove them from this bill on this side. So that's what the A3 amendments do. We ran them by the Building Codes Division. They said they were technically correct. House Bill 3273 is a bill that's aimed at bad contractors. Currently, if you're a bad contractor and you get your license revoked by the Building Codes Division, there's no statutory provision that would prohibit you from going in the next day and reapplying for that license. So it's a pretty simple concept that if you get your license revoked, there's a very good reason. You've gone through a very long process. We call those folks who get their licenses revoked egregious violators because they've continuously violated the law to do something and continue to do something that would warrant their license being revoked. So this bill is aimed at bad actors who have their license revoked so they won't come back in the next day and get another license or come in under another name but still running the business and be able to continue work because they're proved to be violators of the law. So that's what the bill does. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer it.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Broadfoot? Okay. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 3273? Been sitting here anxiously for 2 hours waiting to testify. We'll close public hearing House Bill 3273A and open a work session on House Bill 3273A.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the A3 amendments at 3273.
Senator Starr has moved the A3 amendments to House Bill 3273. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 3273 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3273 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry this bill?
Okay.
Senator Starr will carry. Thank you. Okay. Now, going back to the top of the agenda, we've got two bills left. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 572, and maybe, Teresa, you can brief us as to another bill that has a long journey.
Yes, it's had a very long journey, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, in front of you have two sets of amendments like you did from a last, from a previous hearing on the 17th. The -14s and the -15s are identical. Brian DeLashmit will discuss with you the provisions of 14. The primary difference is that on the -15s, home health agencies are out of the measure altogether.
And the 14th?
And that includes public health as well. So the only groups affected by this bill under the -15 amendments are hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers.
Okay, 15 is hospitals only, 14 is public health. Okay, let's ask Mr. DeLashmit and Ms. Reeder to come forward. And we have talked about the home health issue, public health issue. At least I think not everybody was in committee that day, but we did have that discussion a week or so ago. But there's been other revisions that have been made. So I think I'll ask Mr. DeLashmit, first of all, to do that. Teresa, do the revisions that Mr. DeLashmit is going to refer to, are they also carried through in both
yes.
amendments?
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. DeLashmit, please tell us what has been changed other than the obvious public health issue, but there has been some other changes and how those came about and your position on those.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Brian DeLashmit representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Actually, a picture is worth a thousand words. This is the -11s. Everything that's in pink was deleted. Representative, let the record show that Senator Montes Anderson is smiling because these were discussions with her about deletion. So of the original, I guess I can't even say the original bill, from the -11s to where we are on the -14s and -15s, there's been substantial revisions. Primarily what you're left with is a bill that no longer has the major component dealing with law enforcement, investigating, coming out, taking photographs of the nurses, the victims, looking at records and so forth. What you have left is the ability for the nurse, if it's a criminal assault, as they currently do, to make a phone call to a police agency if they feel there's sufficient grounds to come out and actually do a criminal investigation, that information would then be captured in the uniform criminal reporting system, the same way that they currently capture that information when it's an assault on a public safety officer under federal statute. If it is determined that the individual who has caused the ruckus does not have the ability to make the determination between right and wrong, the Dash 11s and the Dash 14s are still consistent. That report is still taken in-house internally, but is not sent through to the criminal justice system. And the reason for that, obviously, is we want to still capture those types of incidents to see if there's some corrective action that can be taken. There is no longer in the Dash 14s or the Dash 15s a requirement or a duty to report, as there is in a lot of other statutes as far as abuse statutes, that if somebody sees an abuse, they're required to make that report. That is now gone. Also deleted from the Dash 11s is, I believe it was Section 10, which was the actual sanction for the facilities. So we're taking at on face value that if there's a violation of this particular statute, that there will be no sanction, but the facilities that are covered by this will still be in good faith making an effort to capture this data and make corrective action.
I think we have a question from Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Does the bill do anything anymore?
Yes, it does. Actually, it does a couple of things. One is the bill still does have the two-track, as I'd mentioned, in which you're collecting data on where these types of situations are occurring. And that is very, as I'd indicated in one of the earlier hearings when I came before you, one of our primary focuses in this is we know that nurses are assaulted at a much higher rate than almost any other type of professional. So it allows us the ability to capture that data in such a way that then there is a report generated and there needs to be corrective action taken by a facility or the employer, nurse employer, to make sure that those situations don't occur in the future. So that's the main body that still remains. At the same time, as I'd indicated, some of these assaults do occur in situations where there is a patient that doesn't have the ability to make a determination between right and wrong. And we're not saying that those people should go through the criminal system, but we still want to make sure that the nurse employer is doing all that they can do to make sure that the employees are protected or in a safe environment. And that's what that bill still does. Thank you for the question. The Chair has indicated the difference between the Dash 14s and the Dash 15s. The Dash 14s do still include a more refined definition of home health, who is in home health, and does remain in. The Dash 15s remove that. The Oregon Nurses Association encourages the Dash 14s to be adopted. We still do feel, as I know I was not here last week, but you had a discussion about home health, but we do believe that there are home health situations that, in fact, should be encompassed in the bill.
Thank you. Let's let Ms. Reeder speak, and then we'll ask questions, and we'll see where we go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Sarah Reeder, Executive Director for the Oregon Association for Home Care. Just a summary again, and maybe for Brian's benefit, since he wasn't here last year, last time this bill was heard. Yeah, feels like it. We had collected the data from OSHA as well as from all of the 60 home health agencies in the state, whether they are hospital-based, freestanding, or home health agencies that are county-based, which are the two Curry and Harney County home health agencies, of which there are absolutely zero occurrences of assaults on caregivers by patients. So I think that data spoke for itself. With respect to the Dash 14 amendments, I think that the refined definition that Brian spoke of on line 22 or beginning in line 22, unfortunately, is an extremely cookie-cutter approach, and the reason for which is because it simply requires that home health agencies associated with hospitals are included, thereby exempting any freestanding facilities, freestanding home health agencies, which amount to about a half a dozen of them, which I really don't think that this committee would be interested in requiring the reporting of assaults on caregivers in such a fashion. So I would say that specifically is a very problematic piece of the Dash 14 amendments, and would stick with our contention that the Dash 15s removing home health agencies altogether based on the data that we collected for the committee is an appropriate action.
Okay. Mr. Lashley, I'm going to ask you to comment on that, and then we'll ask for questions.
Well, again, for the record, Brian DeLeishmet, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. The Oregon Nurses Association did an internal poll of our members in a number of facilities, and I understand without being here the information that Ms. Reeder may have provided to you. But from our members, they, in fact, do internally in our polling report incidents in home health settings and feel that those are the places that they're actually the most isolated. They're most often by themselves or in isolated situation rather than being in a facility where there is potential assistance. So they strongly urge the inclusion of home health.
Questions for the committee? Is that a yes?
No. I'm ready for work.
Senator Atkins.
I'm looking at both of them. What section does the 14 have?
If you look at, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, if you look at the dash 14s, starting on line 22, 23, 24,
right,
going on to the 1 and 2 on the second page, those are the lines that are deleted in the dash 15s. And then subsequently, I think if you go back to the 15s, it's the sections that are later that in the 14s that deal with home health are now deleted too.
Section 7 on page 4 of the 14s.
Okay. One more question.
Yes.
To whoever, if we're generating a report for hospitals, who's going to read the report for, we generate the report for home health agencies? Who's going to read that? Is it the home health agency if the dash 14 was adopted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, the reader obviously could be anyone in the state, but if you're talking specifically about who is the ultimate consumer of the information, I think it's probably multiple. I think first it's probably the employees and the actual employer themselves who's generating the report is going to have at least a conscious decision or walking through, here are the incidents that we've had or haven't had in the past year, and how have we, as required in the bill, here's how we've done the corrective action to make sure that those kinds of situations don't happen in the future. But I would expect it to be a document that's accessible to other people if they would want to read it. It could be a community member. It could be somebody who is looking at having their mother or father placed in those types of facilities so that they can understand the incidents that occur in those facilities. So it could be broader, but we're not talking about printing a document that's going to be massively distributed.
Okay, thank you very much. Before we move forward, I see Mr. Bishop is here. Mr. Bishop, would you come up just for a moment, because the wordsmith of the Capitol, who I know has been involved in some of this, and I... we've obviously gone over the bill many times, but if you can give me the hospital's perspective on the rewrite compared to the previous rendition, I would appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We have previously testified on at least a couple of occasions expressing our objections and specific language changes that we think should be made to this bill, and many of those changes have been made in this bill. I am reduced to a relatively small number of technical drafting issues that I would raise for the committee, but they are not major, as the objections are not as consequential as they were in the original bill or in earlier versions. These amendments substantially reduce the burden. I'm not convinced that there's a need to pass a bill to do this. I believe hospitals are doing many things already to make them safe places for patients and for visitors and for staff. But my objections to these versions of the bill are substantially reduced. I would point out that there are issues of confidentiality in the reports, and the level of detail that will be provided in these reports is there won't be much detail in these reports because of confidentiality and privacy concerns about disclosing specific incidents. Those would be available in police reports, but employers like hospitals may not be able to provide that level of detail in their reports about the specific incidents. So the reports that will ultimately be produced will be high level and probably won't provide a lot of information that most of us would be interested in reading.
Mr. Bishop, questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have before us a Dash 14 and a Dash 15 amendment. And again, the Dash 14 includes home health services. The Dash 15 does not include home health services. Discussion on the Dash 14 or Dash 15, I'm going to leave this up to the committee to tell me what they think. So please offer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
I've gone back and forth because I've spent quite a bit of time with Sarah Reeder, and I have worked public health and I have worked home health. They're two distinct different entities. And I really feel that if we are really truly wanting to do something for nurses and the safety of nurses, that we should really include the home health. And I don't think it's going to be that much of a problem because already Ms. Reeder already stated that there hasn't been one assault. And so if nurses don't feel there's a problem, there isn't going to be an issue with there. But if there happens to be somewhere where they maybe need, because of their clients, need to have their annual training. We always did in public health. We never did in home health. But in public health, we had our annual. We had practice drills, believe it or not. We were told what to do when we went into these at-risk families, especially with criminal activity going on. And it really is an important issue, and I think it needs to be raised to the level that it should be put in statute.
Thank you, Senator. Other comments from committee members? Senator Atkins?
I think those are fantastic comments. She's colleague is certainly the expert. To me, it just seems, though, that having them in there for the sake of generating a report seems unnecessary. I think that if this report, even completely watered down for privacy issues, is going to be used as a marketing tool, where in Harney County people don't have a lot of choices where they might put their ailing parents, I just see this as unnecessary. So I'd support the Dash 15. So does that mean we cross each other out?
Yeah, we cross each other out.
Okay. All right. Let's proceed down the line here. Senator Starr.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think that the report that Ms. Reeder provided us in our last hearing is pretty compelling. And based on that information, I'd support the Dash 15s.
Well, I'll see if Senator Deckard puts me in a situation or not. Senator Deckard, your thoughts.
I've had one clear and consistent position on this whole bill and this whole issue, and I'm going exactly where Lori Montes Anderson's going on this and following her. So I'm for the Dash 14s because Senator Montes Anderson is for the Dash 14s.
Okay. Well, okay. We're going to take a vote on this, and before I do, I again, as I have in the past, want to declare a potential conflict of interest before we vote, because my company does represent employers who will be impacted by this bill. Let's take the roll.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do I have a motion on the floor?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry. Go ahead, Senator Starr.
That's 15.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 15s to the floor to do past recommendation. Okay. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I'll vote no on that motion.
Senator Montes-Anderson?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Chair Lester?
No.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes Anderson.
I move the Dash 14s to Senate Bill 572.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved the Dash 14s to Senate Bill 572. Please call the roll.
Senator Atkins.
No.
Senator Decker.
Vote aye.
Senator Montes Anderson.
Aye. The dash 14s have been adopted. Next motion.
Senator Metzger.
Senator Deckard.
I will move Senate Bill 572 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Deckard has moved 572 as amended by the dash 14s after putting me in a real ringer adopted with the dash 14 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Further discussion for the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'm going to support the bill. I think it's an important bill. I think the policy is important. I didn't necessarily believe that the home health folks ought to have been included, but that issue has been resolved, and I think the underlying bill is important, so I'm going to support the bill.
Thank you. Further discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Decker?
Aye.
Senator Bob
Simpson? Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Aye. So it's carried. Senator Mona Sanderson, would you like to carry the bill, being the nurse?
I would love to.
Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson will carry. Okay, our final bill today is a public hearing on Senate Bill 672.
Work session.
Excuse me, a work session on Senate Bill 672. I'm sorry. Teresa, if you could fill us in on 672, where we are on this one, which is a long time ago since we discussed this topic.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we had our first hearing on this on April 7th, and then at the end, the conclusion of the hearing, you had asked Eric Carlson from the Senate Majority Office to head a work group between members of the Altamont Homeowners Association, the Condominium Homeowners Association Working Group, to work together on some compromise amendments. What you have in front of you, the dash 5s are the end result, replaces the measure. What it does is that it allows planned community and condominium homeowners associations, or HOAs, to use electronic notices and electronic ballots for owners or board members who have consented to use such means of communication, and it outlines the usage of such electronic communications. It establishes that if a planned community or condominium HOA fails to fill vacancies on its board of directors sufficient to constitute a quorum in accordance with the HOA's bylaws, a owner or first mortgagee may request the county circuit court in which the planned community is located to appoint a receiver to manage the HOA's affairs. The amendments also state that a condominium declarant may amend the declaration or bylaws in order to comply with requirements of listed federal agencies or any state or federal department, bureau, board, commissioner, agency that insures, guarantees, or provides financing for condominium or condominium units, and also clarifies the list of governmental entities that a declarant of a planned community can amend the declaration or initial bylaws, which is currently under statute. It allows planned community HOAs to buy liability insurance with a higher deductible than might be allowed by current HOAs declarations or bylaws. It also requires planned community HOAs to issue summaries of a proposed annual budget to all homeowners in the community at least 10 days before adopting the annual budget, and a final version of the budget to be distributed to homeowners within 30 days after adoption. And it also adds an emergency clause effect upon passage.
Okay, we have a sign-up list for us here somewhere.
No.
Members, this, as you call, this topic was very broad. And there's a number of bills dealt with a number of issues. And what I asked Mr. Carlson was, look, we're not going to be able to deal with all these with the time we have. And I agreed to some of the parties through Mr. Carlson that if you could agree on some parts of this that you thought were valuable, then we would proceed with that and leave the others to future discussion. And my understanding was that these parts do that. We'll about to find out. Mr. Carlson, would you come forward, please? Please identify yourself. Would like to comment on this bill. Mr. Vile, please come forward. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Okay. Mr. Carlson, without great detail, please, maybe give us the substance of what I asked Mr. Carlson to kind of freak these people together and see what we could agree on and that we thought was important. And if you could do that, I would appreciate that.
How do you print them together?
Please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Eric Carlson, Senate Majority Office. The bill is arranged a little awkwardly. It contains about five subjects: electronic notice and electronic ballots for both planned communities and condos. And you need to understand that the planned community provisions are in Chapter 94 and the condo provisions are in Chapter 100. And so when you want to do a general amendment of the laws dealing with these communities that are governed by declarations, you have to amend two separate chapters.
Okay.
So we have a new provision for electronic notice and electronic ballots, and as Ms. Van Winkle indicated, in order to use those, the homeowner or condo owner has to consent. It's not something that can be forced on them. There is a provision for the appointment of a receiver, and that's in the situation in which a condo or homeowners association cannot agree on the election of a quorum of a board of directors. And somebody needs to be able to run the association in that situation. There are some provisions dealing with insurance because the insurance market has changed. There are a number of homeowner associations and condo associations that provide for a very low deductible, like $500, and they provide it in their bylaws or their declarations. There are many companies now that will not offer insurance at that level, and those that do charge a very high premium. So this bill authorizes the associations to raise the limit in the insurance policies that they buy, deductible. There are a couple provisions dealing with notice, one of which deals with notice of regular meetings and the other of which deals with notice of budget meetings. There are a couple of technical provisions, one each for condos and planned communities, that deal with financing. And what they do is allow the board of directors to amend their bylaws or the declaration so that it's easier for people to get financing under a wide variety of federal programs. And then there's a provision for planned communities that changes the lien foreclosure provisions from a non-judicial foreclosure to requiring the use of judicial foreclosure under Chapter 88. Those were the provisions, the main provisions that were agreed on by the parties. There were some other things that were agreed on by some parties and not others. The main thing that's not included here are provisions dealing with disclosures by sellers. That's because we discovered there are some provisions for disclosures currently in statute. That is a very complicated subject, and it was simply not possible to deal with those over the course of the last couple of months during session. Mr. Weil has had some experience with the issue of disclosures, and I think we'll second that comment. So if you have any specific questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thank you for your work. Mr. Weil, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and maybe give us your comments on what you think this accomplishes and why it's good public policy for us to move forward with at least this portion of this issue.
Richard Weil, a lawyer from Portland, representing condominium associations. Our law firm represents about 1,500 condominium and planned community associations. By the way, is the fastest growing segment of our residential market. There virtually are no even single family homes being built unless they are within the confines of a planned community anymore in the state of Oregon. And so this is a very, very rapidly growing area of the law. As a result, there are many, many things that we are learning between every session. And one of the reasons why we see the complexity we do each session is because of that. Want to express appreciation to the chair for getting the resources of the Senate Counsel's Office in helping us to arrive at a number of important provisions. We're in a position to support the bill as it's presently written. I'm here representing both the Community Associations Institute, the national organization that we have a local chapter of, as well as the Oregon-Washington Community Association managers and those homeowner associations that we represent.
Mr. Rao, thank you. What would you say is the key, a key, or maybe a couple of key provisions in this bill that you think really, again, makes real good public policy by moving this forward?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I believe that the clarification that we do not have judicial foreclosure in Oregon is a very important one. That has been an issue throughout the country where we hear a lot of media discussion about the little old lady in tennis shoes thrown out of her home for a few hundred dollars unpaid assessments. That simply cannot happen here without judicial intervention. And this bill clarifies that. That was our practice previously, but the law would have allowed for it in theory. I think the other one is the change in the notice provisions. We now have longer notice periods for folks so that individual unit owners or lot owners are able to know of a board of directors meeting and participate in those board of directors meetings, particularly if they deal with budget issues. These other provisions are the insurance provision, for example. There are a lot of associations that cannot get insurance today because their governing documents say $500 deductible and there is no such policy for sale. And so that's a very important provision. And, of course, electronic voting and electronic notice is something that makes it much less expensive for homeowners associations to notify their members and to conduct their business. Those are a few of the key provisions. From the approximately 26 issues that we had floating around out there, we certainly appreciate Eric Carlson's efforts to synthesize some of those, and we look forward to this being a starting place for even more improvement of the law as we go forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Vile. It's nice to know we're not going to throw Grandma out in tennis shoes without judicial, you know, oversight. I'm feeling better all the time. Senator Montes Anderson.
Yes, I have a question regarding electronic voting, and I'm not familiar with it, but I certainly think it's needed. But what about fraud, you know?
Chair Metzger, Senator Morris Anderson, there are a lot of folks who are concerned about that, and so what we have written into the bill is that it has to be the consent of the person who is going to be voting electronically before that is the way they will vote. If you are concerned about fraud as a unit owner, you reserve the right to vote with a written ballot or some other means that protects that right.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, again, thank you very much for your hard work on this. Anybody else want to testify? Any issues with the realtors on this bill at all? Okay. Thank you very much. We're in work session with a voluminous dash 5 on Senate Bill 672.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 672.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 672. Discussion? Objection? Storer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 672 as amended to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 672 as amended by the dash 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I don't see, I didn't get over the hurdle why we need a bill to have condominium associations act like government, so I'll be opposing this. I don't know why we need a bill to do this.
Mr. Vowell, do you want to comment on that? I mean, I think that's a good question, so you're the expert on that. Let's tell us why we would need to legislate.
Chair Metzger, Senator Atkinson, I tend to agree with you, Senator Atkinson. It would be...
very rare in this committee today.
It would be, in my mind, wonderful if these many municipalities, as they really truly are, they are municipalities in the context of raising money, paying bills, providing services, government, all of the things that municipalities do, had the benefit of municipal kind of the breadth of municipal law. We simply do not have that. We have in Oregon a tendency by some to resist the regulation of homeowner associations. I think that's short-sighted. I think that we will ultimately evolve towards that, and perhaps at some point little towns and cities and homeowner associations will have the opportunity to have similar provisions. But in the meantime, there are approximately 500,000 homes covered by a homeowners association, and without many of the provisions of this bill, they do not have the benefit that they need to properly operate those homes. They're interdependent upon one another. There's just no question. It's inescapable. And you sign up for that when you buy the home. And cities and counties are requiring it now. You can't subdivide a piece of property in Multnomah County without having a homeowners association be responsible for certain common properties.
Okay, we're going to recess for a second for the tape change. Because this is all public record, and you can see James is
frantic. I'm probably glad most of that didn't make it on the record, I suppose.
Okay, we're back on. Okay, another question there, Senator? Okay, good question, good response.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions or comments? Okay, we have adopted the dash 5. We have the bill before us as amended. So, any other questions? Please call the roll.
Senator Axon?
No.
Senator Decker?
Excuse
me. Senator Montes?
Yes.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Chair Metzger?
Aye. It is carried. Who would like to carry the bill?
Can I?
I don't think I see nervous people out here. Nobody volunteering?
your bill.
Okay, I'll carry it. I'll carry it. I'll carry it. I'll carry it. I'm happy to. I'll carry it. Thank you all. By the way, on Thursday, we are going to meet briefly, I believe, and to move fills.
Wasn't our agenda canceled or something?
No, actually it was canceled, but that was because the agenda was not officially approved by the president, so we had to remove it.
So we're going to move some bills to some other committees. So okay. We're adjourned.
Thank you.